Good afternoon and welcome to Open Air, KLW's weekly radio magazine of most things culturally considered. I'm your host, David LaTulipe. This week on the theater front, actors Craig Marker and Gabe Marin will be talking about their roles in the San Francisco Playhouse production of Bengal Tiger and the Baghdad Zoo. Actor-director Russell Blackwood shares some details about Shocktoberfest 14 at the Hypnodrome, which will commemorate the 125th anniversary of Jack the Ripper murders. What are you doing for the anniversaries? We'll find out about that. And on the music front, composer Michael Dougherty will be talking about his residency with the New Century Chamber Orchestra, and we'll continue our highlights from the month-long Architecture in the City Festival, which focuses this closing weekend on home tours. Architect Carrie Bernstein and Mark English are here to talk about the tours. And to close, a little bit of music from birthday boy George Gershwin. Stay with us. Opening on October 1st at the San Francisco Playhouse is Bengal Tiger at the Baghdad Zoo, a Pulitzer Prize finalist written by Rajiv Joseph and directed by, I'd say, frequent guest here on KLW's Open Air, Bill English, the director of San Francisco Playhouse. It's going to be running through November 16th, and two of the actors are here with me today, Gabriel Marin and Craig Marker. Gabe returns to San Francisco Playhouse, where he was previously seen in The Mother, Yes, F with a Hat, Wirehead, Landscape of the Body, Bug, Jesus Hopped the A-Train, and Our Lady of 121st Street. Some recent credits include stints at the Marin Theater Company, San Jose Rep, and Center Rep Company. Mr. Marin was named Best Actor by the East Bay Express in their Best of the East Bay 2010. Congratulations there, Gabe.
Thank you.
And welcome back to Open Air.
It's great to be back on the show. Thank you.
Craig Marker also returns to the San Francisco Playhouse, having performed in critically acclaimed productions of Wirehead, The Story, and First Person Shooter. Craig, welcome to Open Air.
Thank you, sir. Thanks for having me.
Oh, pleasure to have you. So, how did you guys first come by this play?
I think it was probably around the same time. I was doing a recent show at the Playhouse called Reasons to Be Pretty. Neil LaBute and
I was finishing up Hat, and
So we're right around the same time, and then Bill English asked us about it, gave us the script, and I sent a note to Gabe because we've done some shows together around town, and I said, you know, this Bill's asked me about this. I think he mentioned you're going to be a part of it too. So are you in?
Yeah, and Bill was pretty excited. This is a play that he's been after for 5 years, and that was only held up because it had its big productions in L.A. Prior to its Broadway run with Robin Williams as the Tiger. So the rights weren't even available until that was done. As soon as they were available, Bill snatched them up, and I could see how excited he was. And as I started to read the play, it just kind of blew me away. It's a beautiful piece of writing. It's very poetic, and it's unique. I can't think of any other play like it, especially one written that takes place during the Iraq conflict in 2003.
Well, let's get a little synopsis of it. The title of it is Bengal Tiger at the Baghdad Zoo. I think we all remember hearing some stories about how the Baghdad Zoo was completely obliterated, mm-hmm. wild animals roaming the streets of Baghdad. So let's have a synopsis of what's going on here.
Well, the play started from a small article in The New Yorker that Mr. Joseph read about an incident that he kind of used as a stepping stone to write this play, and it's about these two U.S. Marines, Tommy and Kev, who are on detail to guard the zoo that has been bombed, and there's still some animals left, one of which is a Bengal tiger. And then there's an incident involving the tiger where mauls one of the soldiers, and that sets off this... this one incident affects these, just completely changes these three people, or two people in a tiger's lives, and that's the beginning of the story.
Hmm.
And the play starts off with a Bengal tiger talking to the audience.
I should mention that the Broadway production, the Bengal tiger, was Robin Williams.
Yeah.
You guys are playing the soldiers in the play.
We're playing the soldiers, and Will Marchetti is the tiger.
Will Marchetti, okay.
Yeah. And
so it's a philosophical view of the tiger that starts things off? Or?
Yeah, you have this agnostic...
A metaphysical, maybe.
Yeah.
He goes on his own journey through the play. It's this one moment, like Gabe is saying, that was the springboard for the whole play, that you've got a tiger that's talking about what has just happened at the zoo and that the lions have escaped. They're running through Baghdad, the streets of Baghdad, like they're suddenly free, hip, hip, hooray. And he stayed safe. He played it safe and stayed back at the zoo.
It's not a la Lion King, though. He's not in a tiger outfit or Tony the Tiger.
He's dressed like Will Marchetti. He is dressed like a man who is in a cage. So it's we hear a lot about magic realism in rehearsal right now, where, you know, the dialogue is very realistic. A lot of the action is very realistic, but there are these magical elements in it.
I was going to say the dialogue with the tiger. I'm not so realistic on that one. But
well, starting with that, and then a number of the characters in the play are deceased or come back as ghosts and haunt the living. In certain cases, ghosts haunting other ghosts. And in that respect, it's very philosophical, as a lot of these characters are searching for what is the meaning of life, and finding hope in very dark circumstances. And
I keep thinking about it. I've talked about this with some of the other people on the show and people I'm around, that it reminds me of what Waiting for Godot was after World War II, that you've got this big event that happens that so many people are taken away from the earth entirely, just gone, and all this destruction. And what do we do now? What does it all mean? And then you get this play that comes around. And at the time, people are like, what is this? This is nothing like we've seen. But it is really the struggling with the, okay, in the absence of something, what is left? And I think this is the first one that takes the Iraq conflict, and it's not a war play. That's the springboard, just like this event at the zoo during wartime is the springboard of the play. It's this moment is the taking the event and then saying, well, what have we learned from this? What do we do after a war? And what do we do after the recent struggles we've had after 9/11 that led to this event that leads us anywhere in life? So you get a tiger that ends up as a ghost who's then trying to figure out, well, how am I a ghost? How am I stuck here? What is going on? And then other individuals have the same kind of struggle through the play of, well, how did I get to this spot in my life and moving forward?
And at the same time, it has very, very practical goals. As, you know, Fritz, my character, has a long objective of trying to retrieve his gold toilet seat. And in all of this, there's a lot of humor. It is a very, very funny play, and I think that's something that really moves it along.
Well, let's bring up that gold toilet seat. I'm sure that piqued someone's ear on the other side of the airwaves here. Gold toilet seat. How does that work into the
Well,
plot?
Well, my character is most proud of, as he'll tell you at the top of the show, of two items that he has looted, or he has won in his mind.
Liberated, shall
yes,
we say.
From the mansion of Uday and Hussein's. And when he was there at the raid of the house. And these are two items that he brought back from them. And one's a gold toilet seat, and the other is a gold-plated automatic pistol, semi-automatic pistol. And these are pretty much mean the world to Tommy. And so being separated from them is very difficult, and he has the goal of reuniting with those two items. That's his journey.
There's definite symbols. There's a lot of symbols in the play. There's grass or topiary, animal topiary that appears in the play, and they're a symbol for certain characters. You've got the gold toilet seat and the gold gun that make prominent appearances throughout. And
one of the primary characters of the play is Musa, and he is he's the translator for the two U.S. Marines. But prior to the Iraq invasion, he was the gardener for Uday Hussein, and so he took care of the garden. Not only that, but he was an artist in topiary, And so much of our set, much of the play is decorated with a lot of these bombed out topiary pieces from, you know, giraffes and lions and bears, sometimes missing a limb or their head or what have you. And that really serves as a kind of a poetic backdrop to this play.
Speaking of missing a limb, would it be giving away too much to talk about a key part of the play where a limb goes missing in some way?
No, I think that that's fair. I think okay. it's the starting place for the play. Tommy,
is that your character?
My character is attempting to feed the lion. I mean, feed the tiger, who's very very hungry, and he loses his hand in the act. And so I've been doing a lot of work in rehearsals with, to act with a prosthesis and, mm-hmm. How would I use it? What's the learning curve on that? Where is my character at? Mm-hmm. So that's a lot of, work that I'm doing at the moment.
Sounds like a ticket home out of Iraq is what it sounds like.
Except for, exactly. And it was a ticket out, but he re-upped and came back
because
he needs his gold toilet seat and his gold gun. And that's why he's back.
Priorities, what we value. That's kind of the symbols what these things symbolize for the people and what they lose, what they value, and how that value changes.
And when you're losing his hand and not being able to have the post-military life that he thought he was going to have makes the importance of this gold toilet seat, this gold gun, which he plans on hitting eBay with, that's going to be his livelihood and that is going to be his life.
And it's like, this is everything that a good theater production should have. It's got violence. It's got a gold gun. It's got a talking tiger. It's got ghosts, topiary, animal topiary. It's going to be quite a production. And their new space at SF Playhouse, it's a big, nice, beautiful old theater.
It's a gorgeous theater, it really is.
It's got a lot of good stuff to come, a lot of eye candy.
That's Craig Marker. He and Gabe Marin are starring in Bengal Tiger at the Baghdad Zoo at the SF Playhouse, directed by Bill English. Opens October 1st. So tell me about some of the preparation you must have gone through. Do you guys either have military experience? Do you know anything about Iraq other than what we've heard in the headlines?
Well, I actually, a few years ago, I did a show up in Marin at Marin Theater Company that I played an Army private in the Iraq War. A whole different journey, but there was a lot of research I had already done from that. There's research I've done through this. I work day job in roofing, and some of the guys I work with are ex-veterans. One's a Marine. Another guy served tours in Afghanistan and Iraq in the Army. And so I haven't talked too much about them because you never know what to bring up and what not to. But just being around their personalities.
Especially when you're on a roof.
Well, exactly. with their personalities, though, you know, in the stories that I have heard. And then there is the hard research you do, whether it's online. There's a lot of video references through the public television side of things, through Frontline, through all kinds of different mm-hmm. resources. There's a lot of coverage that obviously happened through the Iraq War. Mm-hmm. But we also have an Arabic dialect coach because my character at one point towards the end of the play has to speak in Arabic. And, it's a whole other thing. So there's that element, too, of learning different culture and how that operates in the play. So there's definitely a lot of research that you have to do and many different resources to pull from.
How about you, Gabe?
I have no military background myself, but I've done a lot of research online. I've watched a lot of videos. Also, once again, doing a lot with prosthesis and how that psychologically affects you. I've played a few parts where PTSD is an issue, and so I've done a lot of research there. I point out that our Arabic advisor on the show was in Iraq in 2003, up until 2006, and he worked at the State Department, and so which I didn't realize until a couple days into rehearsal, which blew me away, and I was like, really? Did this? So he's been a great resource as far as asking questions about what the protocol is and what really happens, and he's been a great first-hand resource.
Right, and Bill English, no slacker of a director either.
Oh no, not at all, not at all. I mean, he's quite a visionary. Not just in the rehearsal hall, but also as a leader of the theater. And if you look at what you know, he's accomplished with the Playhouse over the last decade. It's astounding. It mm-hmm. really is astounding, and I think that, you know, everybody's hats off to him.
So, Gabe, do you know, or Craig, do you know anything else about Rajiv Joseph, the playwright?
We were talking a little bit in the car. He hasn't been part of the rehearsal process. Bill's been in communication with him. Usually when you've got a playwright at a new play, you still have communication somehow through him.
Sure.
Even when we did Reasons to be Pretty, there was communication back and forth with Neil LaBute with the director and the playwright. So you do get feedback. So there's been some of that back and forth. But the Playhouse did another one of his plays a few years ago, Animals Out of Paper, at their old space on Sutter. But we've done our own, you know, looking up our own research on him as well, that he was from Cincinnati.
Went to university there in Ohio. You know, one thing I want to add to that, having a connection to the playwright is important, because sometimes the information that you get from the text in the script is from the playwright, and sometimes it's just somebody describing what was done in the production. So sometimes we'll need some clarification on that. And to find out what something truly meant or what the playwright meant. And so being able to have, you know, direct discourse with the playwright is very helpful. Mm-hmm.
And how is the dialogue writing? I mean, he's a new playwright, but he's written a couple of plays. Does it need tweaking? Is there room for improvisation, or is it all pretty set?
This has been through a couple of incarnations. I know it's had a lot of workshops. The play was mounted twice with two productions over 2 years before it went to Broadway. It's pretty tight.
And there's no mistake that it was a Pulitzer finalist. Not only just in the what happens during the play itself, the content, but the way he structures it. And I think that's where a lot of playwrights have been given credit, is how they structure it. And coming from an actor's point of view, how he uses punctuation, he mm-hmm. separates out a line, like one line is a sentence, and then you have a paragraph, and then it's another broken out line. So you know, okay, I'm going to speak all of this paragraph and then stop, point this line out, and then go again and point this, you know, he really tells you what's important.
Yeah.
And what's a question mark and what's a statement, what's, you know.
And that's key as an actor with all great playwrights, is are they consistent with their clues? You know, and they'll, you know, for instance, in letting you know what they want to be a beat changed, what is a pause, what they want to run through on. And as long as you can key into what those clues in the script are, that is also very helpful.
Just like a good musical score,
right? Mm-hmm.
They paint that picture right on the page.
Very nice. That's Craig Marker and with Gabe Marin. They're the two soldiers performing in Bengal Tiger at the Baghdad Zoo. Remind me of the tiger's name again.
Tiger.
Will Marchetti.
Oh, Will Marchetti.
Tiger. Very, very good, Gabe.
Well, all the lions are named Leo in the play.
Yeah, it's a running gag. Like all the lions, they're all named Leo. Because they're lions. They're not tigers.
Yeah, he's not even Tony the Tiger. I mean, we don't even know. Yeah,
no.
All right. Well, Marchetti.
Thanks for coming in, guys.
Sure,
thanks
my
for
pleasure.
SFPlayhouse.org to learn more about Bengal Tiger at the Baghdad Zoo, being directed by Bill English. Pulitzer Prize finalist Rajiv Joseph was the playwright. It runs through November 16th. Once again, SFPlayhouse.org. For more information. Still to come, more about our house tours here in San Francisco, ending the Architecture and the City Festival. Shocktoberfest 14 is going to be discussed, and a talk with Michael Dougherty, composer. Stay with us. We'll be right back. That's the music of Michael Dougherty, composer. The work is called Strut. It's part of the concerts that'll be done shortly by the New Century Chamber Orchestra. Michael Dougherty has been hailed by the Times of London as having a maverick imagination, fearless structural sense, and a meticulous ear. And he's one of the most commissioned, performed, and recorded composers on the American scene today. And delighted to welcome to the KLW studios. Hi, Michael.
Hey, it's great to be here.
Joining Michael is Parker Monroe, is the New Century Chamber Orchestra Executive Director. We'll talk a little bit about the season as well. Welcome, Parker.
Thank you.
So, Michael, great stuff happening here. You've been in residency at the New Century Chamber Orchestra. Talk to us about what that entails.
Well, it entails going to rehearsals and talking to people. I'll be introducing the pieces at the concerts, the four concerts coming up this week, and also, you know, working with the orchestra.
You've got some intriguing titles to some of your works here. One, Viola Zombie, is also going to be done for two violas on this program. It's all music of yours, with the exception of a final Sook Serenade for String Orchestra in E major. Tell me about how you come up with these titles.
Well, you know, my music reflects American culture, icons, historical figures, and so forth. So all the titles for my pieces are doormats to the listener to enter into my musical world.
Okay. And I understand Elvis is a recurring theme on some pieces.
I did a couple. What's great about this concert, they're doing five works from different periods, a very recent work all the way back to 1989. So it's kind of a retrospective of the work I've been doing the last 25 years. But one of the pieces is Elvis Everywhere, inspired by, at that time, my interest in Elvis impersonators. Uh-huh. So we have three Elvis impersonators, which are pre-recorded, and then strings playing along with that.
We'll hear a little bit of Elvis Everywhere in just a bit, but I wanted to get Parker Monroe in on this conversation here. Parker, how did you come across Michael's music first?
Well, we've been familiar with Michael's work for years and years, and Nadja and I have talked about, and music director Nadja Slana Sonnenberg and I have talked about how much we'd like to have him come in and work with the orchestra. So it was just a matter of the stars aligning and having his schedule align with ours. And Michael's no stranger to San Francisco. He's worked with the Kronos String Quartet. He's had music performed by the San Francisco Symphony. So he's a familiar figure on the San Francisco musical scene. But now we wanted to bring him back to work with us. And an important thing that he didn't mention is as a part of his residency with us, he'll be working with the New Century Chamber Orchestra both in September in our four concerts that are coming up this week. And he'll be coming back from Ann Arbor, where he lives, and performing, working with us in November, and we'll be premiering a violin concerto that he's writing for us, and I'll let him tell you more about that perhaps in a little bit. And then we're going to put it on our next compact disc and have it distributed worldwide.
Fantastic.
So we're very excited about working with Michael.
Nice, nice. I've talked with Dawn Harms about the NCCO and Nadja
right.
as well, so it's an exciting season.
She's just great. She's our associate concertmaster and one of the greatest violinists in San Francisco, no doubt about it.
How are the venues apart from San Francisco that you're playing in? Are these regular venues for you now, or you're exploring others?
We're exploring others because Herbst Theater is going through doing their seismic retrofit right now. So
right. We're
sort of taking our show on the road. So here in San Francisco, we'll be at the Yerba Buena Center for the Arts at the lovely Lamb Research Theater, Yerba Buena Center for the Arts. That's on Saturday night at 8 o'clock. And then we'll be in some of our traditional homes. We'll be at the Osher Marin Jewish Community Center for a Sunday matinee, 5 p.m. on Sunday. We'll be at First Congregational Church at 8 p.m. on Friday night.
And we're
also trying a new venue down on the peninsula, Mountain View Center for the Performing Arts. And that is tonight at 8.
Very nice. Michael, tell me about some of the other works that we'll hear on these concerts.
Let's see. I have a piece called Regrets Only, which is sort of my interest in writing tunes. You know, writing a melody is really hard to do, and it's funny because I love pop music from the 40s and 50s and 60s. Right now, we don't hear a lot of melody in pop music, which is interesting, or in modern classical music as well. So I've decided to go back to writing tunes, and that's what you hear in this piece. Regrets Only.
Okay.
Regretting we haven't heard melodies for a long time.
You know, so. Yeah, there you go. Uh-huh. And you mentioned American culture-inspired works. I see that not on this program, but Niagara Falls was an inspiration. Jackie O was inspiration.
Mm-hmm.
Any other American touchstones that are inspiring this program?
Viva is a piece for solo violin, which is sort of my tribute to the Rat Pack. And remind me what else we have.
Well, tonight. You're going to do one, I think, probably based on the movies called Viola Zombie.
Oh, yeah, the Viola Zombie. That's my Twilight Zone riff, so to speak. Yeah, each piece is sort of, riffs off or reframes American culture in some sort of way. And the piece I'm writing for the concert in November is a Frank Lloyd Wright piece inspired by his architecture and life called Falling Water, and that'll be a concerto, which Nadja will play the solo part with strings.
Oh, so
I'm very excited about that piece.
And we just got the score, and it's fantastic.
So and, you know, composers are notorious for being late. Usually I finish my piece like 2 weeks before. But this one I actually get done early, so I'm excited.
And how is that scored?
It's for violin and strings.
Oh. Right. And yeah. And New Century Chamber Orchestra is a 19-piece string chamber orchestra, so that's just perfect for us. And it's wonderful to have the piece a little while in advance, because that means that our music director, not just Solana Sonnenberg, who is the soloist, can go back home to New York and work on it for a couple of months, which she will.
And something I should say about strings, you know, quite often when I work with orchestras, you think of strings, you think of the string players sort of in the back row, kind of, you know, not really into it. These string players play with 150% energy. I mean, like, you've never heard string players play like this. So the energy is like a rock band. You know, it's just it's very exciting to hear them play live. So
they absolutely do love it. And one other thing I'd like to add is that we're also going to be performing Sunday morning at Cal Performance's Fall Free for All at Zellerbach Auditorium. That's their kickoff for their season for Cal Performances.
Indeed.
And they invited us to open the program at Zellerbach Auditorium. So we'll be there, and I hope Michael can be there and do a little bit of play-by-play for the announcers, the audiences for that one, too.
Okay. All right. I'm not an early morning person, you know. I compose late in the evening. So.
Michael, speaking of your composing process and your family, you come from a family of five brothers.
Yeah.
I don't know if there's more involved, but they're all professional musicians. How did that happen?
I don't know. You know, I just grew up in a normal home back in Iowa, but my parents loved music, and they just let us do whatever we wanted to do. And we started a rock band, you know, the Doherty Boys, you know, called the Soul Company. And it's great. And all my brothers are active in music, different kinds of music. So, but it's great, yeah.
Nice. These concerts, more information about these concerts at ncco.org. Once again, tonight in Mountain View, if you're heading out there, you can catch the works of Michael Doherty. Tomorrow in Berkeley, and then Saturday here in San Francisco at Yerba Buena, Sunday at the Osher Marin Jewish Community Center in San Rafael. Tell us a little bit about what we're going to go out with here. It's a tune that's going to be heard on these concerts called Elvis Everywhere.
Well, sure. It's a piece I wrote for Kronos Quartet back in 1993. And at the time, I was very interested in Elvis impersonators. So to find Elvis impersonators, this is before the internet, right? So how did you find Elvis impersonators? You had to go to the Elvis Impersonators National Convention in Las Vegas. And I went there and found three Elvis impersonators and then constructed a script. They recorded it, and then I wrote the string quartet part. But it's really my homage to Elvis. In fact, you know, I'm a composer who lives my music, so believe it or not, I was in Ypsilanti, Michigan this summer, the Elvis Fest with Elvis impersonator. So I really do like the Elvis thing. It's just it's a lot of fun. It's really kind of wraps up American culture, you know, the good and the bad of American culture.
Do we hear and see the range of Elvi throughout his life?
Yeah, you do. Exactly. Yeah. It's everything from, you know, the early period to, there's all sorts of quotes of Elvis. And of course, the piece ends with Elvis has left the building, you know. So we're going to start with the beginning of the piece, right, where we hear different. And so they're all little quotes from Elvis or things that Elvis did. So,
all right. That's Michael Doherty. His works will be performed at the New Century Chamber Orchestra concerts this weekend. And Parker Monroe, Executive Director, thank you, gentlemen, for stopping in.
Okay.
Thank you for having us.
We appreciate it. We'll see you at the shows.
Indeed. Now, here is Elvis Everywhere, music of Michael Doherty.
You can't play unless you can do Elvis. Can you do Elvis?
Viva Las Vegas! Hey, Margaret!
Yes, I'm
wish I was in the land of cotton. Oh, things they're not forgotten. Look away, look away, look away, you Dixieland.
That's right, baby.
Dixieland, where I was born. Early Lord, one frosty morn. Look away,
look away,
look away, Dixieland. Look away. Look away,
look away,
look away, Dixieland.
That's right, baby.
Baby, 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 baby.
You're a great audience. You know, someone said that the world's a stage and each of us play a part. The stage is bare and I'm standing there with the emptiness all around. Elvis everywhere. You know, someone said that the world's a stage and Elvis everywhere. The stage is bare, and I'm standing there with the emptiness all around.
Yes, I'm back. I'm still alive. Oh, I'm back. I'm still alive. Oh, I'm back. I'm still alive. I'm still back. I'm still alive. Oh, I'm back. I'm back. And I'm still alive.
I'm at the cave, my heart.
I'm in Pontiac Stadium.
And I saw
you outside. You can find me in Kalamazoo.
I'm at Caesar's Palace in Las Vegas.
The Burger King.
I'm in Aloha from Hawaii.
I'm in the
backyard.
Well, I'm still alive.
Well,
thank you very much.
And good night, Jay. You've been a great audience.
Thank you
for coming.
Thank you very much. I love you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Good night, everybody.
Good night.
Good night. You're a terrific audience.
Good night, ladies.
I'm glad I had this opportunity to be with you
tonight.
Good
night, ladies, and good night, gentlemen.
Good night, everybody, because Elvis is leaving the building.
Thank you very much.
Good night.
I'll see you later.
Yeah, Elvis is leaving the building. Elvis is leaving the building. I swear. Elvis is leaving the building right about now. Good night, ladies and gentlemen. You've been a terrific audience. Elvis has left the building.
Elvis has left the building. That's Elvis Everywhere for string quartet and tape by Michael Dougherty. You can hear that as part of the New Century Chamber Orchestra's performances in Mountain View tonight, tomorrow in Berkeley, and Saturday in San Francisco here at the Yerba Buena Center, Sunday at the Osher Marin Jewish Community Center in San Rafael. More information at ncco.org. Nadja Salerno Sonnenberg will also be performing Dougherty's Viva for solo violin, Viola Zombie for two violas also on that program, and the Sook Serenade for String Orchestra rounds things out. ncco.org. Good afternoon. It's Open Air on KALW. I'm David Latulib. Continuing now with our continuing coverage of the Architecture and the City Festival here in San Francisco. The 2013 San Francisco Living Home Tours program is capping off the festival this weekend with 10 distinct residences open to participants over 2 days. And here to talk about those residences and how those are chosen is Carrie Bernstein and Mark English. Mark English is a Bay Area native who is principal at Mark English Architects here in San Francisco. His firm has a special interest in building in the urban context, with more than half of its work occurring here in San Francisco. He edits two respected online magazines, The Architect's Take, which features original interviews and commentary, and Green Compliance Plus, featuring residential energy compliance case studies and advice. Mark, welcome to Open Air.
I'm glad to be here.
And Carrie Bernstein practiced in New York for over 6 years before opening her San Francisco office in 1995. The office of Carrie Bernstein Architect is committed to progressive design with an emphasis on craft, quality, and light, taking important consideration not only to the customers' needs, but to the site that they're working on. They work very well on the needs of their clients. She's also a member of the 1% Solution, providing a minimum of 1% of her firm's working hours to assist nonprofit organizations with their own design and planning needs. Carrie, welcome to Open Air and KLW.
Thanks, David. Thanks for having us.
So how are these tours, how are the homes chosen for the tours?
Well, the homes are chosen by a selection committee of architects mostly, and they are it's an open, you know, it's an open call to architects and design professionals to submit photos, et cetera, information about the homes that they would like to be considered. The committee goes out and actually looks at first looks at photos and information, and then selects a number, usually twice as many, that actually end up on the tour.
I was going to say, are these just submitted by architects, or would a homeowner be able to say, oh, you guys should put my home on the tour?
Oh, I think they could do that, absolutely.
Is it a case, maybe, Carrie, of everybody's baby is beautiful, and you have to have the unfortunate role of saying, yours not so much, or at least not for this particular tour?
I think the committee has an interest in putting together a program that's really going to show the public a good range and good quality set of projects. Mm-hmm. So I think the projects also, how they fit with each other is as important as the individual quality of each project.
Mm-hmm. So we whittled these down to 10 residences. Let's discuss them. Or at least where are we starting on the tour?
Great. So I think some general considerations that the committee looked into had to do with, you know, different building types and so forth. And we didn't want all very expensive homes. We didn't want homes that all resembled each other. And in a town like this where construction is so expensive and the entitlement process takes quite a while, we wanted to focus on homes and some multifamily homes that showed the best bang for the buck. And so on this tour, we have modern residences, some single family, most single family, but others are multifamily, like the Octavia or the project in the Marina, which is a three-unit building, which exhibits really fantastic design solutions at a low cost because it's a developer project. Mm-hmm. And the architects there, Edmonds and Lee, I think did some fantastic things in reconfiguring what the long and narrow San Francisco flat should be like.
Mm-hmm. And what are some of the other showcase homes that will be on the tour?
Well, we've got Paulette Taggart's beautiful modern Telegraph Hill home, which is full of sustainable materials, has a fantastic staircase and incredible views. We've also got John Maniscalco's Butterfly House, beautiful modern expression. We've got the Zero Cottage by David Baker, which is quite a one-of-a-kind project made of, which is really a cottage in a backyard, which is a project type that I think we'd all like to see more in a city that is developing density. And he's done it with his usual sense of humor mm-hmm. and amusement.
Okay, how so? We can't really show it on the radio, but can you maybe describe how the humor is worked into the architecture?
He's used many pieces and building materials from other projects. Some of the materials are reused. There are, he's used rubber tires, abandoned tires as planters. He's got wall systems and glazing systems from that were left over that he's incorporated into the building. And its very shape is very exotic in a way.
Mm-hmm. That's architect Mark English involved with the weekend long home tours aspect of the architecture and the city final weekend. Carrie Bernstein, I understand one of your houses is involved in this tour in Glen Park. Tell us about the Hill House.
That's right. The Hill House is a renovation. My clients started with an 1,100 square foot small 1930s bungalow type house and wanted to expand it just a little bit. It stayed a single story over a garage. The lot is unusual. It's a 40-foot wide lot. Most San Francisco lots are 25 feet wide. We expanded it just a little bit to the side and just a little bit to the back. But really the biggest transformation was the qualitative aspect of the design, going from a small, dark cottage with a series of rooms and a lot of hallway, not much connection to the outside, to an open and airy, modern plan that really is connected to the landscape. Surface design did a beautiful garden in the back. And you have a new way of living that really is expansive and connected to the outside much more than the old house, which was very interior and very, very self-contained.
Mm-hmm. So the tours of the various houses, they're self-guided. Obviously, someone will be there at each of the residences during certain hours. Are anyone from AIA and American Institute of Architects involved with the tours themselves?
Each house will have a number of docents uh-huh. who have been briefed and prepped about the house, and visitors can ask the docents questions about materials or process or other elements in the house. The designers of the houses will also be at each house to answer questions.
Could one of you or both of you address the affordable housing that's going to be on the tour? And that's hard to imagine those two words in San Francisco right now, affordable housing. But what's being included in the affordable housing area?
This is such an important part of the tour. The American home is such an iconic part of our lives in this country, and yet affordable housing and urban housing just couldn't be more important in a city like San Francisco, where real estate is so expensive, and our city really wants to include the broadest possible range of economic diversity mm-hmm. as possible. Mark can speak about the project, but every year the AIA has really made an effort to include one community or affordable housing type of project specifically to show the breadth of housing and ways of living in the city.
Mm-hmm. And so, Mark, what is being showcased in affordable housing?
I think there are really two projects. The first and most obvious is the Kelly Cullen Community by Gelfand Partners Architects. And that's a large-scale multifamily development, renovation, remodel. And
you know, I think uses parts of an old building in a beautiful way, and then reconstitutes the interior and shows us all how to gracefully do that, and within budgetary constraints. And as I mentioned before, I think that the Chestnut Residence, the multifamily by Edmonds and Lee, is very interesting for most of us who really can't afford a single-family home but could live in a two- or three- or four-unit building on a 25-foot wide lot but want some of the architectural drama that a good architectural designer can give. So those are both great examples of affordable housing.
Mm-hmm. Festival wrapping up this end of September. What's your takeaway from this year's festival? Carrie Bernstein.
I think that there is a tremendous commitment to living in the city, that families are making an enormous effort to find a space for the adults and the children in the city, taking older properties and improving them for a newer life without overexpanding. I think many of the houses are probably undersized relative to what we've seen in the past. You have a number of people not trying to maximize their zoning envelope and really having a strong sense of propriety about the scale of their buildings and yet wanting to live a modern life with children in the city.
Hmm. Must be some specific challenges about building in San Francisco. Is it more so than other cities and other areas you've worked with?
Well, absolutely. The entitlement process is very involved here, even for a single-family home. In fact, right now we've got, we as a city have 4,000 units under construction, more or less, and another 4,000 in the pipeline,
wow,
which we need. There were years that we had 10 or 20, and there is no other city of this size and importance that has that kind of pattern of building. So we're very excited at the AIA in the amount of interest that the general public is showing and has shown during this whole month of September, and the concepts of how the importance of housing is only going to become more amplified as we go forward, mm-hmm, as a city.
Architect Mark English and Carrie Bernstein, thanks so much for coming in to talk about the home tours aspect of the festival wrapping up.
Thank you.
Thank you, David.
And more information about the final weekend of home tours and the properties being showcased is at archandcity.org. Archandcity.org for the wrap-up of architecture and the city.
I'll light the fire. You place the flowers in the vase that you bought today. Staring at the fire for hours and hours while I listen to you play your love songs all night long for me, only for me. Come to me now, rest your head for just
Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young, Our House. Do visit those houses on tour this weekend as part of the Architecture and the City Festival, archandcity.org. Talk of a very different sort of house next on this final segment of Open Air. I'm talking with Russell Blackwood, who is Thrill Peddlers Company founder and director, who produced his first Grand Guignol horror play 20 years ago with his own adaptation of the 1926 shocker, The Laboratory of Hallucinations. Shocktoberfest 14 focused on Jack the Ripper, an evening of horror, madness, spanking, and song will be commemorating the 125th anniversary of the Jack the Ripper murders in London. It's at the Hypnodrome. Here to talk about that is founder and director Russell Blackwood. Welcome.
Thanks for having me, David.
Sure. Well, now, why did you choose Jack the Ripper? Just because of this coincidence of the anniversary?
Well, for years we've been producing Grand Guignol Terror Theater, which was a genre that started in Paris in the 1890s, and the theater ran through the 1960s. The Grand Guignol would produce a combination of terror plays and sex farces, multiple shows on a bill. And a handful of years ago, copy of this play from 1934 called Jack the Ripper in French arrived in my hot little hands. I had it translated at the time and was kind of holding on to it. And then lo and behold, I hear that this year is going to be the 125th anniversary. So I thought if there's ever a time, it's now to mount this Jack the Ripper piece.
Indeed. But the whole Shocktoberfest 14, the focused on Jack the Ripper, is there's more elements to the show that would be happening.
It really is a Victorian-themed show rather than a Jack the Ripper-themed show, though Jack the Ripper is the centerpiece of it. We're also doing a Victorian whipping play called A Visit to Mrs. Birch and the Young Ladies of the Academy.
Here's where the spanking scene comes in.
Yes. Okay. And that's a piece that we opened the very first Shocktoberfest with in 1999 at the Exit Theater. And it was written anonymously, perhaps to be performed in a brothel, perhaps to be read with one hand. But it is a Victorian whipping play.
All right. A terror and titillation ahead for you at the Hypnodrome. Thrill Peddlers presents Shocktoberfest 14. Now, how did you first get interested in the whole Grand Guignol stuff?
I founded the company with Daniel Zilber, who actually grew up around the block from me in Kansas City, Missouri. My dad is a scene designer and designs the Hypnodrome shows. His dad grew up in Paris. And as kids, when he saw that we were both interested in theater and into horror movies, he told us about this theater called the Théâtre de Grand Guignol that he remembered as a kid. There was very little written about it in English. And graduating from Boston University in 88, Daniel came out for the graduation. We were in the BU bookstore, and there is Mel Gordon's book, Grand Guignol, Theater of Fear and Terror. So I bought that, and for the very first time, we had information about the genre that led to adapting one of the plays in the book and mounting it here 22 years ago.
Wow. Now, this is going to be opening on October 3rd, running through November 23rd. Tell us about the cast of characters involved.
Well, as I say, it's a multi-play bill. So in addition to Mrs. Birch and Jack the Ripper, we also have a piece that's inspired by Oscar Wilde's Salome, composed by Scrumbly Caldwin, who was one of the original members of the Coquettes, the psychedelic drag musical troupe.
Right, and a recent guest
used
here,
to
by
perform.
Way.
And he so. Often works with us at the Hypnodrome, reviving the Coquette shows. But this was a piece that was near and dear to his heart that he originally wrote for a show called Wild Boys at the New Conservatory Theater several years ago. And this seemed the perfect opportunity to revive it since we were doing Victorian sensationalism. Salome certainly falls under that header. The next piece on the bill is inspired by a double murder that occurred in San Francisco in 1895 on Bartlett Street in the Mission at the Emmanuel Baptist Church. And this was at a time where newspapers in this town were really vying to be number one. So it's the big days of Hearst and DeYoung. And the trial, from the time the murders occurred to the time that Theodore Durant was executed, was about 2 years. And so there was this constant, you know, one-upmanship from paper to paper, as well as lots of theories about who other than Theo Durant could have committed these murders. Robert Graysmith, who wrote the book on the Zodiac Killer, came out with a book a handful of years ago called The Bell Tower or The Jack the Ripper Murders Solved in San Francisco. So not only does he tell the story about the case in this book and the newspaper war that went on simultaneously, but he also fingers the pastor of the church, Pastor Jack, as a distinct possibility for being Jack the Ripper.
Oh, okay. Well, Russell, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there. More information at thrillpeddlers.com for Shocktoberfest 14, Jack the Ripper, Horror, Madness, Spanking, and Song. Thanks very much for talking a little bit about that today.
Thank you.
Sounds of the Ukulele Orchestra of Great Britain performing the Danse Macabre. I bid you adieu for this week. More information about Shocktoberfest 14 Jack the Ripper at thrillpeddlers.com. My thanks, as always, to my co-producer, Neil Swinkles, for helping making Open Air possible. Recent broadcasts available and comments, please, at klw.org.